Good morning. My name is Dave Merchant. I'm with the Federal Defenders of Montana, and I represent Brian Barker.
And if you could keep your voice up, please.
I will try. I would ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
It counts down. We'll try to help you keep track.
Thank you very much. Last week, the court issued an order asking us to be prepared to discuss the 851. I did not argue it in my brief. It was argued in the previous brief. What I had done was simply by reference and tried to incorporate that. In reading the rule and reading the case law, Your Honors, I messed up. I should have argued that.
It's a little complicated for us to go find the briefs. In fact, it was very complicated.
Absolutely. And I have a suggestion to the court. I would suggest to the court that it allow both myself and the government to simply cut and paste what was submitted before under the new heading and submit it by close of business on Friday and not argue it today. I think that it was properly briefed and argued the first time. My mistake, I guess, would have been when the court issued the remand, it simply said, we're not getting to that yet. And I just assumed mistakenly that it would join the other appeal, or my appeal. So with that suggestion to the court, if the court would like another way to do it, I am more than happy to oblige the court. But I think if we simply submitted what was previously done to the court, it would answer the question. And to be quite candid with the court, it's not the strongest argument in this case.
Well, submitting that, it sounds like a good idea. We're happy to have you do that. You might be asked questions about it today nonetheless.
Nonetheless, thank you.
This is our chance to have at you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. With that said, this is one big conspiracy. The government says, I'm trying to argue that, and that's exactly what I'm arguing. And what I'm asking the court to look at as a framework or as a foundation to this, we have a Missoula indictment from 2003. We have a Billings indictment from 2004. We have a plea agreement from the end of 2003. Now, the standard is very clear. In construing the plea agreement, if the court finds that the plea agreement is ambiguous, then the court orders us to determine what the defendant reasonably believed to be the terms of the plea agreement at the time of the plea.
Yeah, just an ordinary contract construction.
Absolutely. And this court has already found the plea agreement to be ambiguous. So what was Brian Barker thinking at the time of the plea? Think of it in these terms. Missoula indictment comes down.
In doing this, would you address, because there is information in the record that indicates that you were not the counsel who negotiated this, correct?
I was not. Rob Stevens was.
Stevens. He sought assurances or clarification in the course of the discussion, I guess it was over a day's period or 2 days period, that what was encompassed, and the record reflects that the U.S. Attorney's responses were ambivalent.
That's what Rob Stevens testified at the evidentiary hearing.
I thought. So in that light, are we talking about a breach of contract, or are you arguing that there was no contract, no meeting of the minds?
No, Your Honor, I'm arguing that there's a breach of contract.
Why wouldn't this be a case in which there was no agreement and the remedy would be to vacate the plea agreement? Well, you can go ahead with your argument, but I'd like to sort of understand what the nature of the contract dispute is here.
I will.
Because, just to explain why I have this concern, if you step back and look at it as a breach of contract, there's ambivalence on both sides. Mr. Stevens is advising that it'll sweep in everything, and yet when the drug amounts for the pitch are not included in the drug amounts, well, he knows it's gone light, so the subsequent conduct of the U.S. attorney would imply that they're not interpreting it the way you are.
I understand exactly what you're saying.
So it sounds like maybe both sides had a reason to be a little ambiguous in what the scope of the plea was, and the question is whether that would defeat a mutuality of understanding at the time.
That may be the case here. And that's kind of what the district court when it issued its order, said that Mr. Stevens was walking that fine line.
Yeah.
The problem becomes with that is the standard requires what was Brian Barker thinking at the time of the plea. What Rob Stevens was thinking, quite frankly, is irrelevant. And we know that the pitch weight isn't included in the relevant conduct 3 months later. The pitch weight, that pound of methamphetamine, Rob Stevens says, yeah, this is probably light. But the day that this court orders me, as a defense counsel, to come to the district court and say, you know, you guys missed a whole bunch of weight. We need to ramp up that relevant conduct. My guy needs more time because they simply missed it. The day that that happens is a sad day for the American justice system. So the fact that Rob Stevens may have been walking that fine line, quite frankly,
it's all part of the Sixth Amendment. The government's entitled to effective assistance of counsel, even if it comes from the defense.
And unfortunately, that may happen more often than not. With this, though, quite frankly, Your Honors, we have the Missoula indictment is the time, place, and people. Missoula indictment is December 2002 through March 2003. Missoula, Great Falls, Billings, and elsewhere in the District of Montana. It involves Barker, Tetzloff, and others. That's very important. We know that the Billings superseding indictment is January 2003 through July 2003, Billings and elsewhere in Montana. Barker, Amanda Brothers, Sheila Pitch, and others. The Missoula plea agreement says no further action, and the language that we are all focusing on is acts or occurrences giving rise to this indictment. That's the key to this, Your Honors. Here's the problem. When the discovery dump was done on Rob Stevens and Brian Barker, it included everything, including the July 2003 arrest. All of that stuff from July 23rd, 2003 back was included. Sheila Pitch was debriefed just after the pound of methamphetamine gets to her in June. That stuff is there. And
What's the date of the First Amendment? The first indictment, I'm sorry.
December 2002 to March of 2003.
No, I'm sorry. What's the date on which that indictment was handed out?
May 7th, 2003.
Right. So, obviously, the acts or occurrences giving rise to that indictment were all those that were prior to that indictment.
Absolutely.
So how do we then say that an act in July of that year, that is to say after May, was an act or occurrence giving rise to that indictment?
Because Sheila Pitch knew on June 10th of 2003, she told law enforcement that she had known Brian Barker for 6 to 9 months. She began dealing with him in December 2002. She got use quantities of methamphetamine. It ramped up. She got 2 ounces, 4 ounces, a couple of times, and then 8 ounces. All the way through May of 2003. In June, that's the first time Brian Barker sends her the package. It's the first time mail is used.
But is the conviction under the second indictment based on any act that occurs prior to the date that the first indictment is handed up?
Well, it's based on the second indictment is for the individual act of July 23rd and the conspiracy. The court ends up finding him not guilty of the conspiracy.
The conspiracy falls out, that's right, because that's count one.
Right. The problem with that, though, is Pitch is part of the conspiracy in the first indictment. She is receiving methamphetamine. She is selling methamphetamine.
Let me ask you this, because I find this case somewhat difficult, because the pieces are odd, and I'm not accustomed to reading quite this language. So would you be making the same argument if the second indictment had never included count one, but had only included counts two and three?
I probably would.
Because at that point, conspiracy is entirely off the table. Not merely now acquitted conduct, but this is now unindicted conduct, and the only indicted conduct is conduct that takes place after the date of the first indictment.
Right, but the plea agreement that Brian Barker agrees to in October is for that conspiracy during that period of time and others in Billings. He just assumed.
Well, I understand, and others may very well include Pitch. I got that part.
Right.
But that's an indictment for a conspiracy with a specific end date, according to the indictment, or even if we extend it beyond the date specified in the indictment, which is March 2003 to May, the date the indictment is handed up. Nonetheless, the event at issue in the second indictment under which the convictions are obtained, counts 2 and 3, is later than that last date, that is to say May 2003.
That's
so,
absolutely
so, so how do I say, I mean, I'm trying to understand your argument sympathetically. How do I say that the later date, the July date for that event, is somehow covered under the plea agreement when, in the words, act or occurrence is giving rise to this indictment, meaning the earlier indictment?
My time is about to run out.
We'll talk as long as we need to get it right. Yeah.
Brian Barker, on October 27th of 2003, believed in his head, and it's unrefuted at the evidentiary hearing, that his plea agreement would take care of everything.
Yeah, but I have to say this one. He can believe anything he wants in his head, or he can say now he can believe anything he wants in his head, but as we ordinarily do with a contract, I mean, I look at the words of the contract, and there's an outer boundary to the ambiguity, and if it's outside the ambiguity, he can say whatever he wants. And nonetheless, is, I think, available to a district judge on remand, as it was to Judge Siebel, to say, you know, you can say what you want, but here's the outer boundaries of the ambiguity, and here's what I find was the meeting of the minds.
The pitch affair was an ongoing part of his conspiracy. It began in December 2002, and it ended when the package was intercepted by law enforcement in June of 2003. When Brian Barker was at the plea colloquy, he was very clear with Judge Malloy, I'm trying to avoid life. In fact, they had a colloquy with the government's attorney, the defense counsel, and the judge talking about that. Brian Barker was concerned with getting life.
Right.
And what he thought, this isn't Brian Barker, as I say in Montana, his first rodeo. His criminal history is quite extensive, going back to 77, I believe.
Right.
So he wanted to make sure that this plea agreement stopped the bleeding, that this would be it.
Right. Counsel, sure. Let me just understand your argument. You want this court to rule that where you have a written plea agreement, as was the case here, we should ignore the language of that agreement and try to find out what was the private, unexpressed interpretation of that agreement by one of the parties to the agreement. That's what you want us to decide and rule in this case.
Not quite, sir.
All right.
What I want this court to do is...
No, I was just summarizing...
Right. That's the government's
argument. ...the colloquy that just concluded.
What I'm asking the court to do is to, as this court has previously found, there's an ambiguous term because it overlaps in time, it overlaps in place, and it overlaps in people. And because of that ambiguity, then we're obligated to go to what that person was thinking. And we have to think of it as reasonable.
Right.
And we know what Brian Barker was thinking because he had a conversation with the district court about it. He had a conversation with his attorney asking for assurances, and his attorney went out and tried to get assurances.
Right.
And there weren't any assurances.
Okay.
So that's the argument.
I understand.
Okay. Why don't we hear from the government? And although your time's gone over, we were the ones taking you over. We will give you a chance to respond.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Mark Smith, Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Montana. Please allow me to clear one thing up at the very beginning here. The Missoula drug conviction was not used as a predicate offense to enhance Mr. Barker's sentence to life in Billings. I don't think this was ever really squarely addressed on the briefs, but it's important to understand from the get-go here. It was not, these charges were not artificially divided for the sake of creating a predicate offense that you could use to then bootstrap the Billings offense to a life term. There were two state court felonies that were used as enhancement in the Missoula proceeding, and then the prosecutors again used those same two state court felonies in the Billings prosecution. The reason that Mr. Barker didn't get a life sentence in Missoula was because the weight of methamphetamine that he was charged with dealing in that indictment was much less than what he was dealing in Billings. In the Missoula indictment, he was charged with 21 U.S.C. 841B1B, which is keyed to a methamphetamine mixture of more than 500 grams but less than 500 grams. In Billings, by contrast, we have the Sheila Pitch pound of methamphetamine, okay? When you're talking about a pound of methamphetamine, you shift over to 21 U.S.C. 841B1A, which when you enhance it with the 851 enhancement, the two state court felonies, you've got mandatory life. So the point of all of this is, if the pound of methamphetamine that Barker was dealing with Pitch had been included in the Missoula indictment, he would have gotten life imprisonment anyway.
But that's if pigs could fly. I mean, okay, but that's not what happened. So we're looking. I'm trying to figure out what the plea agreement means.
Okay. So the first, I guess, and fundamental question here is what was Mr. Barker's reasonable understanding of the plea agreement? And I think that's what this panel has rightly fixed upon. The first, last, and really the only thing that the panel needs to know about the Missoula plea agreement is that it only forgave conduct that was alleged within or that formed the basis for the Missoula indictment. The Missoula indictment was May 7, 2003. It penalized possession and distribution of methamphetamine in December of 2002. And a conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine.
Yeah, you know, you paraphrased. The precise words may be important. Acts or occurrences giving rise to this indictment. Now, it may mean that that includes any acts or occurrences that are somehow related to the indicted conduct, not necessarily only the conduct for which he has been indicted. Although even if I just read the indictment, I've got the words and others, and clearly the geographic scope goes to Billings. And we do know, I'm just trying to summarize the argument from the other side so that you're addressing it head on, mm-hmm. And we do know that Ms. Pitch is involved in the conspiracy during the period of the first indictment.
Well, I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor. I don't believe that law enforcement knew that, and the grand jury certainly didn't know that.
Well, but the question is not what you knew. The question is acts or occurrences giving rise to it. So it doesn't say in here acts or occurrences known to the government.
Well, the
it says acts or occurrences giving rise, and it may very well be that you've got some conspiratorial behavior that you are not aware of, but you've alleged a conspiracy, and you've alleged others.
I think you have to frame the inquiry in terms of what the indicting body was operating upon, okay? And that's the grand jury. What did the grand jury know?
Well, if you wanted to say known to the grand jury, you could have said that.
Well, acts or occurrences giving rise to the indictment, I think, infers that, Your Honor, pretty strongly. I mean, that's the body that's going to be forming the indictment, that's going to be handing down the indictment.
But, of course, if we're talking about what the grand jury knows, it's very often the case, of course, that the government knows a lot of information that it doesn't give to the grand jury. So you're saying even if the government knew it but the grand jury didn't know it, that what the government knew but the grand jury didn't know, that's not within the scope of the agreement?
No, sir. I'm saying that...
Okay, well, then we better not talk about what the grand jury knew. We better talk about what the grand jury knew and the government knew, even in the terms of your argument.
The relevant inquiry is what the grand jury knew and what the grand jury knew when it handled.
That doesn't make any sense, because what you're saying is he's pleading to something that he doesn't know the parameters of. What you're saying is that the government can come in on the indictment if he doesn't plead out, and can put on things that the grand jury didn't know but were known to the government, and use that against him as part under the conspiracy theory. But then if he pleads to it, you can say, nope, it's only what the grand jury knows, and he doesn't know what the grand jury knows.
Your Honor,
he doesn't know what, there's no limiting principle within the bounds of this agreement, then, as I understand your argument.
I believe the argument is that acts and occurrences that are alleged in the indictment or that gave rise to the indictment, okay?
Yeah.
And so the focus in the district court when it conducted the evidentiary hearing and you know, in all the briefing that occurred there was, well, what was the grand jury testimony?
I understand the argument. I don't understand the logic of it. It's a contract. Your contract says giving rise to the indictment. Well, the grand jury didn't initiate the indictment. What the grand jury did was respond to what it was told by the U.S. attorney. Okay, so giving rise to the indictment means is reasonably what the government knew, what caused it to bring the matter to the grand jury, what it elected to tell the grand jury in secret, and that the grand jury validated, but it does not specify a list of specific acts or things. It talks about what gave rise to it.
You know,
and what I don't understand is what's being negotiated here by the defendant and the government is we will not take you to trial and we will not put on our case in court against you, which consists of as much as we know and we think we can bring under this indictment and under a conspiracy theory. I do not believe the government is going to come into court in October on a May indictment and limit itself to what the grand jury knew. That would not be a basis, I do not think, for the defendant to object and make you lay a foundation before you could bring in that evidence and say, Your Honor, before they can go into this line of questioning, we are entitled to know whether this is what was presented to the grand jury.
I think all of those points are valid, Your Honor, and I think that they would definitely govern those proceedings. But for our present purposes, really, the determinative fact is that anything that was any act or occurrence that was alleged in the indictment or that gave rise to the indictment had to predate the indictment.
Let me ask you this. The second...
That has some resonance to it, but when you allege a conspiracy, a course of conduct, as Judge Fletcher pointed out, the Sheila Pitch transaction was not, didn't, as far as I understand it, there is evidence to suggest that she was involved in the conspiracy, the drug, distribution conspiracy, that the Missoula indictment was talking about. So the fact that the incident where she got arrested happened in July, why isn't that nonetheless part of the conspiracy that gave rise to the Missoula indictment?
Well, that's an interesting dynamic, and this is something that was touched upon in the evidentiary hearing. When the plea agreement says acts or occurrences that are alleged in the Missoula indictment or that gave rise to the Missoula indictment, they're talking about acts or occurrences. A conspiracy is an agreement. An overt act is something that's done to effectuate that conspiracy.
Well,
okay?
Act, but it talks about occurrences. What's an occurrence?
I think it's the same thing. An act or occurrence is an overt act. It's something that is done. A conspiracy is something that's ethereal. It's an agreement. It's not an act or occurrence.
If you enter into an agreement with Sheila Pitch in December, let us hypothesize, I am going to deliver to you, this is an overt act between the two of them. They sit and meet and say, in 6 months from now, I'm going to deliver to you a pound of methamphetamine, and I want you to take the 6 months to go find out where we can sell it.
I think that act or occurrence would not be something that would be immunized by the Missoula plea agreement, because the delivery, the distribution, the possession would all occur after the fact.
Even though she, in the meanwhile, was going around soliciting buyers, potential buyers?
I would say that's
not an overt act.
The overt act that occurred after the date of the Missoula plea agreement would fall subject to future prosecution. That's correct. The overt act that predated, and the conspiracy itself that predated the Missoula indictment, would be subject to prosecution under that indictment.
Well, here's what troubles me. We can attach a specific act of the substantive offense. But we have the creation of an agreement under conspiracy. What evidence does the government show us as to the termination date of that agreement?
The termination date of which agreement, Your Honor?
The conspiracy is an agreement.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about the transaction involving Sheila Pick, you know, the Billings Court found that there was no conspiracy. The Billings Court found that there was no overt act in Billings. The Billings Court found that, in fact, Mr. Barker himself denied that there was a conspiracy in Billings and denied any connection to the Missoula conspiracy. So, you know, trying to establish.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I guess I didn't make myself understood. I want, what evidence do we have on the record indicating the termination date of the agreement to perform certain acts?
Okay. Between Mr. Barker and Mr. Tetzlaff in Missoula and Great Falls, or between Mr. Barker and Ms. Pitch in Billings? You know, I'm not aware whether there was an established termination date for the conspiracy in Great Falls and Missoula. And again, I don't think that there was. I mean, he was acquitted of conspiracy in Billings, so there was no agreement in the first place.
All right. Let me ask you this. Count one in the Billings indictment alleges a conspiracy. And the conspiracy, at least as I understand the second indictment, the Billings indictment, overlaps in time with the conspiracy alleged in the first indictment. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why doesn't count one, merely the bringing of count one, violate the plea agreement?
Well, Your Honor, if you were to have a Venn diagram, you would be able to see that the time frame that was covered by the Missoula indictment overlaps with the time frame that's covered by the Billings indictment.
I do see that, and that's the point of my question.
Right. However, the operative conduct, the overt act that is the criminal enterprise in the Pick transaction, all occurred after the operative time frame of the Missoula indictment.
Well, I'm not sure that that's right. That is to say, we have a conspiracy alleged in the first one, and it includes geographically Billings, and includes not only Barker and Tetzlaff, it includes others, and I assume, is it Pick or Pitch?
People at the time were calling her Pick.
Okay, so it includes Sheila. Others, I mean, that includes anybody, including, I guess, you, but also including Sheila Pick. So I assume that first indictment covers a conspiracy, and if there is a conspiracy ongoing at that earlier time, which it appears from the evidence we have in front of us there was. Now, you might not have known about her role fully until later, but it's pretty clear what we now know, that there was an earlier conspiracy that involved her, that covered, that it was during that period.
I guess the point that I have to go back to there, Your Honor, is that conspiracy, if it existed, and again, there's no evidence that it did, if there were evidence, then theoretically the Billings District Court would have found her guilty of it, would have found Barker guilty of it, but if that conduct, that agreement, that conspiracy was not the basis for the Missoula indictment.
You know, I have trouble seeing that the first count of the second indictment, the Billings indictment, was not a violation of the agreement, given the fact that you're alleging conspiracy, the period overlaps, the geography overlaps, and others includes Pick. Now, turns out the jury didn't agree with you, whether you were able to prove it or not. The jury didn't think you had. What do we do if, and you're not going to concede it, I'm not asking you to, but what do we do if we conclude that bringing count one of the Billings indictment was a violation of the agreement? Because what the agreement promises is the government, quote, shall bring no further action against the defendant based upon da-da-da. So simply bringing the action is a violation. What do we do if we conclude that you violated it in that sense?
Well, you know, again,
does that make any difference?
I don't want to be redundant, but at the time that the Missoula indictment was filed, the AUSA that filed that indictment didn't know Sheila Pitch's name.
You're fighting the hypothetical.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I'm asking you to assume that the first count of the later indictment, that is to say the Billings indictment, does sufficiently overlap with what's in the plea agreement and with the acts or occurrences giving rise to the first indictment, that the mere bringing of count one of the second indictment is a violation of the agreement. I understand you're not conceding that, but mm-hmm. for the purposes of my question, assume that that's so. What do we do?
Well, you know, I think in this circumstance we're talking about harmless error because he was acquitted of that charge, and, you know, basically even if it was a violation of the first of the non-prosecution provision of the plea agreement, he stands harmed by that in no way.
It's hard to sort out sometimes. You know, juries will hear all kinds of stuff, and although we have all these rules about no compromise verdicts, we know that they do that. And they might have decided, you know what? Well, we're not going to convict on the conspiracy, but we're going to get on the particular acts. I'm not sure that it made no difference to them. There's no way I can know. There's no way you can know.
This was a bench trial. I mean,
okay.
I understand.
Well,
what you're saying.
same thing with respect to the judge, then.
Sure. I see that my time is up. There are no further questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Response?
It is not harmless error because he defended that charge throughout the bench trial. He defended the conspiracy.
Yeah, and he wins.
It's not harmless error.
Well, but he wins on that point. Or to say, it's not harmless in the sense that he was forced to defend it, but I think was he paying for his attorney at that time? Was his attorney at that trial a CJA attorney? Or
no, he had retained Rob Stevens on the first case, and when the second case up, Rob Stevens, in my discussions with Mr. Stevens, basically volunteered to represent him in the second because he felt it was a violation of the agreement.
Okay. So he's not out of pocket. It's a pain in the neck to have to defend him, but he gets acquitted on that one. So even assuming that bringing that charge, count one, was a violation, he's acquitted. Yes. So how does that tell me what I should do with counts one and two if I were to conclude that counts one and two are properly brought?
Judge Fletcher, I totally agree with you that simply bringing the indictment that includes that is a violation of the previous plea agreement. And the fact that he may not have paid money to an attorney to represent him doesn't mean there wasn't an emotional cost to that, wasn't a cost to him to defend that charge, because that was obviously the most serious of the charges, because that would have brought in the most relevant conduct and ramped up his, you know, without the 851, it would have ramped up his guidelines, and at that time we had mandatory guidelines.
So what do I do if I assume it's a breach, but nonetheless we end up in the same position at the end as if the count one had never been brought? He's convicted on counts one, on counts two and three. Seems to me the evidence on count two and three was so strong, I'd be astounded if they had been brought alone that there would have been no conviction.
I would suggest to the court that the court should reverse the conviction and allow him to stand trial on those two charges as I stand alone.
Standing alone?
Yes, Your Honors. Okay. But briefly, the question was, what did the government know? Sheila Pitch debriefed in June of 2003, told them that she had been starting in December of 2002. She testified that at a trial, in fact, at page 196 of the trial transcripts that the government supplemented. The other thing was, keep in mind, she was charged with a conspiracy of June 10th of 2003. Clearly, that conspiracy with Brian Barker predates that, because she testifies that Barker shows up and just gives her dope over and over and over and over again. She didn't know when he was come, but she would, when he came, take the dope, give him the money, and go on. There was an agreement, and to say that there isn't an agreement is simply disingenuous. We also know that Sandy Borkland testified at the grand jury on May 7th of 2003, and Sandy Borkland worked with the Missoula high-intensity drug team. We know from her testimony that on December 27th of 2002, that Bill Klunt, who worked with the Central Montana high-intensity, had stopped Barker, arrested him. That's where they get the phone call to Tetzloff to go clean up the house and bring bail money. So we have two different law enforcement agencies. Ross Magnuson works for and is the agent in charge of the Central High Intensity Drug. He's the one that testifies on the Billings indictment. So to say that simply because the prosecutor at the time of the indictment didn't know it, they admitted in the evidentiary hearing that there were reports floating around that had both things. They also said Barker's bringing the dope to Billings. From Billings, he meets Tetzloff in Bozeman. Tetzloff then goes up to Great Falls. Barker goes back to Billings. At some points, Tetzloff goes to Missoula. It's Tetzloff that's in Missoula with Barker's dope. Barker never goes to Missoula. Barker is in Billings, Bozeman, and Great Falls. Tetzlaw is in Great Falls when he is arrested in Missoula. He's also arrested in Sealy Lake, which is north of that. So it's Tetzlaw's actual acts, but it's Barker's dope. Barker's dope that comes through Billings where Sheila Pitch gets her dope. The last thing that, think in these terms, Your Honors, Tetzlaw gets arrested with Cleland in Sealy Lake. He's not on that indictment. He's another. Sandy Borkland testifies at page 19 in the sealed excerpts of the record that Zachary Zonderson was with him when he was arrested in Missoula, Tetzlaw. Okay. He's another, too. Sheila Pitch is just as easily another. Judge Fletcher, I'd like to remind you of McCulloch versus City of Compton. It's a case that you sat on and decided October 23rd of 2008. And in that, this court determined that the plea agreement, we consider the circumstances under which an agreement was made, including its object, nature, and subject matter. Again, Barker thought this took care of everything. That's what Barker thought. What the grand jury thought in May, I don't care about. I don't care about what Rob Stevens thought. I care about what Brian Barker thought and what was reasonable. He wanted to take care of everything. He knew because all that discovery is in what he's reading. He's reading all of that. He knows Pitch is involved in everything that involves the Missoula indictment because that discovery is included. And to say it's not flies counter.
Let me ask you this question just so that I could understand your argument. Of the four counts in Missoula, are you arguing that only the conspiracy count carried over into Billings?
No, because the methamphetamine.
All right, excuse me. Are you saying that all the four counts carried in?
Yes, Your Honor, because the locus, the methamphetamine, starts in Billings. Well, right. It starts in Billings, though, for the Montana conspiracy.
I see.
The last thing I'd like to point out to the court is this.
I'm trying to understand you, but I'm not sure that I do.
People often say that about me.
It's okay.
The last thing is the money. And I know that the government says the money isn't involved, but when Barker gets arrested on July 23rd, he has $36,000 on him. There is a forfeiture clause in the Missoula indictment, and in fact, part of the plea agreement is that he forfeits $25,000. The AUSA says, I came up with that number. I'm not sure where it comes from. The grand jury asked them, where did you get that number? Well, it's evidence. It's out there. We have $15,000 worth of methamphetamine. The government's not going to go sell that to get the money. They had to get the money somewhere. And there's no forfeiture in the Billings superseding indictment.
Right.
So if the money from the Pitch transaction isn't part of the Missoula affair, then the government has to return that money because they didn't lawfully forfeit it in the Billings indictment.
Can I get back to the question I asked before?
Yes.
If you say that more than the conspiracy survived, how do you explain the part of the agreement stating acts and occurrences giving rise to this indictment? Are you saying there's no limitation whatsoever?
Oh, no. There are absolutely limitations.
Well, that's why I was trying to find out whether you... It seems to me that when you talk about acts or occurrences giving rise to this agreement would be counts 2, 3, and 4 of the original indictment. And that the only possible way that I can understand your argument is that conspiracy was sort of open-ended.
Your Honor, I believe that conspiracy is open-ended.
Well,
I think that there has to be a beginning,
right.
And in the case law,
okay,
you can walk away from a conspiracy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, the drugs and the money found, except for the 1 pound, which wasn't there, in July, is attributed to Barker in the Missoula indictment. The heroin's there.
Right.
Are you saying that the limiting principle is known to the government? In other words, does he get a pass on things that they would discover, had no knowledge after May? Or is it enough for your argument that they knew about Sheila Pitch?
I think it's enough for my argument that they knew about somebody, that there was drug trafficking in Billings.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both for your arguments. On the 851 question, why don't we do this? Rather than put you to work that may or may not be necessary, we'll, within the next day or so, if we want the brief such as you've just suggested, we'll issue an order to that effect.
Okay.
So without an order, you're finished with the briefing. If you get an order, it'll come out in the next day or so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case of Barker was United States versus Barker is now submitted for decision. The next case on the argument calendar, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, Oust versus Seeley.